Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Dramatic sea level rise, extreme weather, famine, drought. Those are just a few of the dire consequences scientists predict if we continue pumping carbon dioxide into the atmosphere at current rates. Power plants are among the largest emitters. On June 2nd, the Obama administration is scheduled to release new rules regulating carbon emissions from power plants. Utilities and trade groups are warning those rules will have some dire consequences of their own. Wyoming Public Radio's Stephanie Joyce reports.
Climate change predictions are scary, but people might find the scenario laid out in this ad from the National Mining Association even scarier.
You've got to be kidding me.
Unbelievable.
That's the sound of people opening their electric bills to discover they've nearly doubled.
We can't afford this.
An 80% cost hike. It's something we better get used to if extreme new Obama administration power plant regulations take effect.
Scary, but false. The Washington Post's fact-checker blog gave it four Pinocchios for the claim that electricity bills will double, saying that's, quote, wholly unsupported. But industry concerns about the proposed regs are real. Dan Byers is with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce.
This will probably be the largest rule in EPA history in terms of costs. It's probably going to be unprecedented also in terms of compliance.
And it will have the biggest impact on the nation's coal-fired power plants. Already, 20% of those plants are scheduled for retirement in the next 5 years because they can't meet other earlier emissions regulations.
The greenhouse gas rule on top of that, if it leads to further shutdowns, we're actually genuinely concerned about blackouts.
That's because coal is an extremely dependable fuel for electricity generation. It's easily stockpiled and provides a continuous source of power, unlike wind or solar, which can't be stored, or gas, supplies of which are limited by pipelines. But Byers says even if it doesn't come to that, the effects will be felt.
Any major industrial energy user, the reason they come to the United States is not because we have sort of a labor advantage or some other advantage. The affordable electricity is huge.
In many places, rates will go up, but exactly how much is a big unknown. Early reports suggest each state will have to cut overall carbon emissions by up to 25%, but they'll get to choose how they do it. Options might include trading carbon credits, which are given out like brownie points for reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Or states could increase use of renewable fuels, or invest in carbon capture technology at existing facilities. For some states, reducing emissions by 25% won't be too difficult or expensive. Colorado, for example, started actively working to cut its emissions back in 2005. Joshua Appel is chairman of the Colorado Public Utilities Commission. He says if the regulations give credit for those past reductions, Colorado ratepayers won't feel any impact.
We've had a very thoughtful strategy for reducing these emissions, so I think we're in very good shape.
Appel says that's partly because Colorado isn't heavily reliant on any one source of energy for power. It's a different story in Wyoming, the nation's largest coal producer and a large coal consumer.
Setting a target for the whole state and cinching the whole state down, that would be a problem for us.
That's Al Minear, chair of the Wyoming Public Service Commission. Wyoming exports two-thirds of the power it generates. Minear says that means while the energy is consumed elsewhere, Wyoming would be on the hook for the costs associated with cutting emissions.
Unless you can figure out some way to enforce other states sharing in our reductions because we're selling it to them, we've got a problem.
It's not as simple as just raising the price. Minear doesn't think it's likely that other states will agree to hike their electricity rates to pay for emissions reductions at Wyoming power plants, especially if it's cheaper to get the power from elsewhere or to build new plants in their own states. Minear says if the timeline for reducing emissions is short, that could spell a grim future for Wyoming's coal-fired power plants. The state is already party to a half dozen lawsuits against the Environmental Protection Agency, and Governor Matt Mead hasn't ruled out suing over these regulations, too. But whatever the potential legal battle, the threat of a new rule may already be pushing the energy conversation in a new direction. Even Mead, a self-professed climate change skeptic and critic of any rules regulating carbon, says it's time to start looking at carbon management, capturing and storing or using carbon, as an opportunity.
So that when you look at the end of the coal-fired plant and the smokestack, you know, if we can change what is viewed as a liability into an asset, you know, that provides a lot of solutions.
In that sense, the rule might already be working. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
Coal generates nearly half of this country's electricity and is the largest source of air pollution. The new rules are expected to spur the use of clean coal technology. At least that's the hope of both the coal industry and some environmental groups. Marfa Public Radio's Lauren Madelon has this report for Inside Energy on a clean coal project in West Texas.
The wind is blowing across a 600-acre piece of land in Panwell, currently a ghost town in the Permian Basin of West Texas. Abandoned oil tanks are strewn across the empty field. The directors of a plan known as the Texas Clean Energy Project say a coal-fired power plant will be built right here over the next 4 years. It's a plant some people say will be an environmental game changer.
I am in favor of building electric power plants that capture their carbon.
That's Laura Miller, former mayor of Dallas. As mayor, she was not in favor of the construction of 11 coal-fired electric power plants in Texas. That was in 2007. Fast forward to 2014. Miller now heads up this $3.5 billion Texas Clean Energy Project, which, despite the name, is all about making electricity from coal, but not the old way.
Traditional coal plants take a lump of coal, put a match to it, and it burns up a smokestack, and you try desperately to pull off sulfur, mercury, grit off the coal emissions.
The new twist? Turning coal into gas.
21st century coal takes coal and puts it in a large receptacle called a gasifier, and you add a little pure oxygen and you heat it up to 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit, and you make a gas out of the lump of coal.
Miller says that's what marks this technology.
By putting it into a gaseous form, you're much more easily able to pull out all the bad stuff, including carbon dioxide.
It's a technology called carbon capture and storage, CCS. 8 U.S. plants use this technology right now and bury the carbon dioxide, or CO2, in the ground, theoretically permanently. What's new here is the plan to recycle the CO2. A major Texas utility has agreed to buy captured CO2 to make electricity, and CO2 will also be used to extract oil here in the Permian Basin, the country's largest producing oil field. The operation also makes byproducts like fertilizer and even baking soda. As hopeful as that might sound, critics charge that any use of CCS will slow the country's migration to renewables like wind and solar. But several major environmental groups, historical foes of coal, support the project. Here's why.
If you can find a way, like they're trying to in Texas, to use our coal without contributing to climate change, it would be in the strategic interest of the United States.
Tim Profeta is the director of the Nicholas Institute for Environmental Solutions at Duke University.
Any new technology brings along risks of will it perform and how much exactly will it cost.
Meaning it's a calculated but expensive roll of the dice.
And you never can really answer those questions without actually deploying those new technologies. By putting this capture technology on the ground, we are narrowing the risks around its further deployment, and it's very important to do the first one.
The EPA won't force existing plants to adopt CCS, but by mandating emission reductions, the agency hopes the technology is adopted as new plants are built, making CCS cost-effective over time. The Environmental Defense Fund's Jim Marston says CCS is also critical for emerging energy-hungry economies.
The real opportunity for growth is actually in China and India, where they're continuing to build new coal plants, and we could clean up their plants, and we need to do that very quickly because China is now surpassing the U.S. as the number one emitter of carbon dioxide.
In fact, China's already in this game. China's Export-Import Bank has agreed to lend the Texas project $2.5 billion, making its largest foreign investment in the technology. Changing the U.S. power infrastructure is like stopping a guided missile cruiser. It can't be done quickly, which is why supporters of the Texas project say the technology is important right now. For Inside Energy, I'm Lauren Madelon in Panwell, Texas.
When we come back, we'll talk about education. State Superintendent Cindy Hill joins us, and we will visit with some Wyoming high school graduates. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. After some legal wrangling, State Superintendent Cindy Hill is back in charge of Wyoming education. As the school year wraps up, Superintendent Hill joins us to discuss a number of topics. The first deals with distance, or what they call online education. She recently attended a graduation of students who graduated from a virtual school. Hill embraces various uses of technology in the classroom.
I think you're going to see more and more of it, and you're going to see it across the state. And their students are well prepared and certainly focused on going on to community colleges, the university. You're right. Some are taking online, and some of them are attending public school and taking online in a blended fashion. That's the word that is being used in education right now, blended learning. And I think we're going to see more and more of that. Right now, about 1% of our students are educated solely online. That's in line with the national average.
Is that going to be able to fill some of the voids that we have out there for when it's tough to find a qualified teacher?
Absolutely. And you're seeing that. You're seeing that in districts the size of Natrona County, I believe, are using some of those strategies as well. And also in our rural communities. As you know, Mandarin Chinese is not easily taught in a rural community when you need, you know, obviously you only have so many instructors that you can hire. You're going to hire them for those, you know, reading and mathematics and science and social studies. You won't have instructors in Mandarin Chinese, maybe in Lusk or down in your neck of the woods. We know that, yes, it expands the ability for our students to participate in all kinds of learning.
We talk so much about the graduation rate, and we'll get to that in just a second, but as we look to improve that and maybe not lose some of these kids who have to leave school for whatever reason it might be, do you think this is going to be the way that we make sure that they get their degrees, that kind of thing?
Well, I don't know if that will be the answer. I think we'll have to look at our students and assess that one by one and determine if that's working. I think whatever works for our students is what we need to be doing. You know, we put out our graduation rates, but as we were looking at the fifth and sixth year graduation rates, you're going to notice an increase. So oftentimes people look at the graduation rate and think, oh my goodness, you know, not all of our kids are graduating. Certainly all of us want 100% of our kids to be graduating. But we also know that kids graduate in 5 years and 6 years. Others will complete their high school equivalency on their own. You know that, Bob. And then some will have a high enough ACT score to go on to college without a high school diploma, besides those who go into the workforce. So we wanted to show that those graduation rates with fifth-year and sixth-year graduates actually show quite a few kids are graduating in their fifth and sixth year, and those increase the graduation rates. And if you also look on what we sent out to the state of Wyoming and you in the media, I added something this year, and we compared the expected graduation rates, the expected graduates with the actual graduates. So you can actually compare Albany County School District Number 1 with, let's say, Sheridan 2 or Sweetwater 1 that are similar in numbers, and look and see, you know, how many more graduates were necessary for Sheridan or for maybe Sweetwater to be nearly 90% like Albany County, so that their community can look and see how many that they're missing and maybe come together and design, you know, the best plan for those graduates.
As you look to the future and know that a lot of people are talking about this, do you think we're on the right track?
Until we're at 100%, I would never say I'm comfortable with what is going on here.
One of the things that we talked about the last time you were on the program was standards, and one of the things your department is doing right now is looking for some folks, some actual people in the state who are residents that would be on this 2014 Wyoming Science Standards Review Committee. What are you hoping will transpire from getting regular folks on this committee?
I'm hoping that we have science standards very soon for our districts. That's the result I want to see, and I'm disappointed that in 15 months we're at the same place that we were when I was stripped of my duties. Our school districts are waiting for science standards. They're not waiting. Actually, they've moved ahead. They have to teach every day. They don't have an option. So it's not responsible for the leaders not to provide those science standards. And so I'm hoping that we move along very quickly and adopt the highest science standards for our schools and our most importantly our children.
Did you think that the next gen fell short of the highest standards?
Well, I think that we didn't have a full, let's say, review. And any time that we don't follow a process that includes the important voices of the people of Wyoming, you know, when people are not included who want to be part of this process and they have important information to share, and the values of the people of Wyoming are somehow not included, we need to stop and take a look and reassess our own processes. And that's what we've done. That's what the State Board of Education has asked us to do in the department. Now that I'm here, I'm ensuring that it happens, and we'll make certain that they reflect our values, and certainly they'll be the highest standards, or hopefully we won't adopt them otherwise. But we need to have the highest standards adopted as quickly as possible so that people can carry out their work and know that we're working together.
You know, so much has been made about this whole climate change portion of it. Was it really that simple? Or is that maybe in your mind where some things fell short?
I think there are more questions and concerns than that, but I'll leave that to the committee. That's where the work is really to be done. And then hopefully you'll participate as the committee work comes before the board. So that's really their work. I don't want to influence them one way or the other. I think that their work will ensue here shortly, and hopefully it will be exactly as the people would expect, fair and just and full. It'll be a full discussion.
And maybe just the last point on this, as you said, a lot of the districts have moved ahead and because they need standards, and we heard testimony, I think, at that State Board of Education meeting where there were a number of districts that have gone ahead with standards. Is this kind of muck things up a little bit now that the board didn't take any action, and so they're probably going to have some standards in that they'll have to adjust in the future?
I've heard from districts that the last 15 months have been very confused when it comes to what's expected, and I think that we need to be very clear and we need to move ahead, and again, be respectful. Our job is to make decisions and ensure that the districts know what those are so that they can actually follow the law and fulfill their requirements. And we've not done that for the last 15 months. And I'm glad to be back and ensure that the process moves forward.
Superintendent Cindy Hill, always a pleasure. Fun to talk a little education with you for a change. And thank you for joining us on Open Spaces.
Thank you.
Graduation season is here. Commencement ceremonies around the state mark the start of a new chapter for many of Wyoming's high school seniors. Wyoming Public Radio's Aaron Schrank caught up with the class of 2014 to see how they feel about the big day and the future.
It's the last hurrah for graduating seniors at Casper's Kelly Walsh High School. The Casper Event Center is packed, and the graduates are in high spirits.
Pumped, really. Like, there's not even really words that I can really say.
I'm actually feeling really good about it. I'm glad that I'm out of high school.
Pretty good. I was a little nervous going up there. I didn't want to trip. You know, it was pretty embarrassing.
That was Zephaniah Cannell, Kelly Reynolds, and Carlos Salazar. They've got big plans.
I'm going to UW on a full ride.
2 years of CC, and I want to be a surgeon.
Taking fire science here for 2 years, getting my associate's degree. I want to become a firefighter.
Kathleen.
The three are among 330 Kelly Walsh graduates who will earn, on average, about $5,000 more each year than those who don't finish high school. And in Wyoming, that's an issue. 1 in 5 don't get their high school degree. There are some downsides to graduating. Cannell knows what he'll miss most.
My friends and just the time that I got to spend with them and leaving a lot of them, and that's going to be pretty sad, but hopefully I'll make some new friends and that'll be good.
For so many seniors, saying goodbye to familiar faces eclipses everything else happening on this day. But that's not the case at one ceremony, 100 miles east in Lusk. Jacob Williams has just delivered his valedictorian speech. I ask him what he knows about his fellow graduates.
I hadn't seen any of them in person that I can remember. It's possible I saw one at a field trip or something, but I wouldn't have recognized them.
That's because Williams is graduating from Wyoming Virtual Academy, an online school program of the Niobrara County School District. 19 of the school's 26 graduates came from all over Wyoming for the ceremony. While their school is non-traditional, for graduates, this day is just as special.
I'm so proud of myself. I can't believe I did this.
That's Evelyn Cantu. She's the first one in her family to graduate high school, and she'll be the first in college. She's ready, she says, because her schooling has taught her independence and time management.
It's a little different because you have to self-motivate yourself, and in college you just have to do the same thing. You have to push yourself harder to do what you want to do.
A 2012 report from UC Boulder's National Education Policy Center found that students in online schools like this one were further behind in reading and math scores than those in brick-and-mortar classrooms. But the model works for Donatelia Austin.
And it gives you this flexibility of doing so much more with your life. I was able to go to swimming for 4 years at Cheyenne South High and as well as take two other classes.
She's headed to the University of Wyoming to study art. Before online school, she was homeschooled. Her mother and former teacher, Kyle Cameron, says she's pleased with her daughter's educational path.
I made some good choices. They were some hard choices at times. Certainly I got a lot of criticism, but wisdom is justified by our children. So I feel justified. Woo! You know?
Most students took a more traditional approach at Riverton High School. 160 more seniors are walking across the stage in a muggy gymnasium as friends and family fan themselves with programs. It's pretty standard, modest claps for each graduate, until they get to the C's and Tyler Campsey approaches the stage.
You ready, kiddo?
Campsey has cerebral palsy and gets around school using a wheelchair. Graduation is a big deal, but so is something else he's doing. He's walking across the stage with the help of a walker.
Tyler Jacob Campsey.
Everyone in the room stands to cheer him on. Later, he tells me just how much that moment meant to him.
This is what I've been waiting for 4 years, and it culminated today with the graduation ceremony and seeing all my classmates walk, including me. It teared a lot of us up.
Seeing him walk meant a lot to Campsey's friends, but even more to his mom and dad, Chad and Christy.
Every Friday they would come up here and practice walking so he could walk for graduation. So,
it was something that he had promised to do for my mom. She had passed away 10 years ago. Tyler had promised her before she died that he would walk for her.
This kind of grit is in character for Campsey. He was part of the swim team at Riverton. In the fall, he'll attend Central Wyoming College to study radio broadcasting.
So hopefully I can do well in that field.
For Campsey and for graduates around the state, graduation is quite a feat, but hopefully not a crowning achievement. So it's on to the next challenge. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Aaron Schrank.
When we come back, we will discuss tourism, climate change, and interesting research on carbon capture. This is Open Spaces. This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Yellowstone National Park lost 200 cabins this spring. They were part of the park's largest lodging complex. No, it's not the Old Faithful area, nor Mammoth. Penny Preston reports it's in Canyon Village, where the park's biggest hotel once stood.
The Canyon Hotel was Yellowstone's largest from 1910 until 1960. It was created by Old Faithful Inn architect Robert Reamer.
My parents like to go up there and have dinner.
Hank Coe's parents own Pahaska, the lodge just outside Yellowstone's east entrance. He was a child in the early 50s when the family would drive from Pahaska to Canyon Hotel, just an hour away.
I just remember this huge hotel that sat up on the side of the hill, and magnificent building, just spectacular. Huge dining room.
But the hotel was condemned and burned down during demolition. Coe remembers the unlikely story that was told by the Cody demolition contractor.
My recollection was that in the middle of the winter, I'm thinking in February when there was huge snowpack, lightning struck it or something happened to it and it caught on fire.
It was replaced by 400 cabins. Despite the history, this spring contractors demolished 200 of the old cabins that were built in the 1950s. Rick Honinghausen is the marketing director for the park's lodging concessionaire. Zantara says they are trying to modernize the area.
With the new contract, a 20-year contract that Zantara received, we're putting over $134 million into park investments.
The biggest chunk of that investment will go into five new lodges in the Canyon Village.
And these will be beautiful big five-story lodges, very, very sustainably built. And so the visitor experience should be quite improved.
Honinghausen says the lodging footprint will be much smaller than the one required for the 400 cabins that will all be removed. That's the good news. The bad news is there's going to be a short-term lodging shortage.
Until we get the new lodges in place next year, we'll really just be down about 220 cabins.
Cody Chamber Director Scott Baglio says gateway communities will benefit.
It means that we'll have additional demand for rooms outside the park.
While some visitors may be disappointed they can't stay in Yellowstone this summer, Baglio says the big picture is positive.
In the long term, it's going to be great because those facilities needed to be updated, and that canyon redevelopment will really pay off in the future.
Because of all the changes, Baglio says if you want to stay at a hotel inside the park, you'll need to plan early.
A lot of people show up and think that they'll just be able to go into the park and get a room, and that's often not the case. We try to ask people and then help facilitate that. Sometimes it's calls to the concessionaire in the park, Zanterra. Other times it's directing people to local lodging options so that they have a room for the night. They can use Cody as a hub in and out of the park, so we try to find a good solution for them.
Reporting from Canyon Village in Yellowstone National Park, I'm Penny Preston for Wyoming Public Radio.
As we heard earlier in the program, the Obama administration wants states to cut back on carbon emissions. But doing that has always been a thorny problem. While carbon is a byproduct of almost everything we do, capturing and storing it is expensive. For years, the goal has been to figure out how to make that process cheaper. More recent efforts to take a different approach. As Wyoming Public Radio Stephanie Joyce reports, focus has shifted now from storage to use.
In her lab at the Western Research Institute on the outskirts of Laramie, Karen Walrusik digs around in a fridge for a sample of bacteria.
Oh yeah, so, like that's one.
Walrusik holds up a glass flask filled with an off-white liquid.
If you're gonna take a picture, let me just rub this off.
This is a name scrawled in wax pen on the glass, identifying the strain of bacteria. She doesn't want it in a picture, because that information could be worth a lot of money someday. The bacteria in the flask eats carbon dioxide and produces biodiesel, which can be blended with regular diesel to run cars and trucks and trains. That means instead of carbon emissions going up the smokestack at a power plant, they can be captured and converted into a marketable product.
You're using the carbon twice, basically, before you release it.
That should mean less carbon ends up in the atmosphere, while at the same time making capturing carbon much more attractive to utilities.
We need to have more options available to manage carbon. We think that carbon can be viewed not as a waste, but as an asset.
Lee Bowie is a spokesman for Tri-State Generation and Transmission, which supplies power across the West. He says hundreds of companies are already researching new ways to utilize carbon. Tri-State would like to see even more. To that end, it's sponsoring a competition focused on carbon recycling with a $10 million prize.
What we're really interested in is what are the biological, catalytic, other processes that are available to be able to take carbon emissions, carbon dioxide, and turn that into products that people use every day.
Some might cringe at the idea of buying our way out of climate change, but Bowie says cleaning up carbon for its own sake hasn't worked. Companies have never been interested in spending money to lock away carbon underground for the rest of eternity. Chris Elrod agrees that new ideas are necessary.
In the United States, absolutely 100% use of the CO2 has to occur.
Elrod is the director of finance for Sargas, a Norwegian company that specializes in power plants with built-in carbon capture. He says viewing carbon as a commodity changes the game.
There's billions and billions, if not trillions of dollars of market share to be had in this business.
Sargas has built several test facilities, both in the U.S. and abroad, to demonstrate its carbon capture technology. It's currently working on a full-scale commercial plant along the Texas coast. Elrod says that plant will capture more than 90% of its carbon emissions, which will then be sold to a nearby oil field. Pumped underground, carbon dioxide boosts oil production, and in the process, some of it gets trapped, effectively sequestering it.
It's not completely sort of energy neutral, but we think it's actually a very efficient way to utilize energy.
Exactly how efficient is an open debate. Capturing and reusing carbon, carbon utilization, is all the rage. But at least when it comes to enhanced oil recovery, some projects might actually emit more carbon than burning conventional fossil fuels. Elrod agrees it's not the final answer.
This is a bridge. This isn't a global solution that's going to be the sort of panacea here. This is actually something that's going to get us to a future where we actually have low carbon intensity power generation and efficient use of energy.
Getting there is a race and an experiment that much of the world is counting on. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
In the next half century, scientists are predicting more extreme weather for Wyoming, with bigger winter storms and hotter, drier summers. That's according to the latest National Climate Assessment out this month. Wyoming farmers and ranchers are skeptical about climate change, but they have been forced to adjust their methods of production. Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards reports.
On the High Plains east of Cheyenne, Leonard Mosier is a longtime wheat farmer. He's seen all kinds of weather in his 60 years, but he's not so sure climate change is real.
Well, I don't believe in the climate change because we've seen a lot worse during the 30s when you had the Dust Bowl.
But Mosier does admit he's had to change his practices and has become an organic farmer because he believes the soil isn't as good as it used to be.
We've been farming this ground for 100, 120 years, and we've been taking a crop off of that ground every year. And what we're not doing is putting the micronutrients back into the ground. And that's one of the reasons that you're seeing crops not as healthy as they used to be.
But a researcher at Harvard School of Public Health thinks there's a better reason why crops aren't as nutritious. Samuel Myers conducted a large-scale study of CO2's effect on crop nutrition in plants like wheat and beans. While Mosier blames unhealthy crops on poor soil, Myers says there's another reason.
Rising concentrations of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere are threatening global human nutrition by reducing the amount of really important nutrients for human health in crops like rice and wheat and soybeans.
In other words, increasing CO2 may be causing plants to grow faster, diluting important nutrients like iron, zinc, and protein. In the future, he says it may be necessary to engineer crops to act more like corn, which is better able to handle drought and heat. But there may be more to it than that. Jay Norton is a professor of soil fertility at the University of Wyoming. He says crop nutrition starts in the dirt, and that's because soil is ultimately a product of the climate.
I always link it to a compost pile. The more you stir the compost pile, the more rapidly it decomposes. And it's the same with the soil. The more you disturb it, either with tillage, with wetting and drying, with freeze-thaw, the more rapidly you accelerate decomposition of organic material and then return of that fixed carbon to the atmosphere as carbon dioxide.
Norton says that's why hot, dry summers and wet winters will make Wyoming soils less fertile. He says an example of how not to cultivate crops in Wyoming are sugar beets, the state's number one crop. They are planted in deep furrows that require a lot of wetting and drying. He says that's going to lead to trouble in the future.
You can't harvest sugar beets without seriously disturbing the soil. And they also require high inputs of nitrogen and phosphorus fertilizers. So their footprint in terms of climate change is larger than crops that don't require that level of disturbance.
And it's not just Wyoming soil that's a concern. The swings in wet and dry are also hurting livestock producers. The nation's cattle herd is the lowest in 60 years due to frequent droughts. But heavy snows are also an issue. This year's wet winter and severe cold was especially challenging. University of Wyoming beef cattle specialist Steve Paisley says it forced ranchers to make some adjustments.
The guys that are moving calving to a later spring to try and avoid some of those extreme cold temperatures.
He says ranchers are also scaling back how much hay they produce, how much forage grass they raise, and how many head of cattle they stock. But he says ranchers are also slow to adopt methods that would reduce the effects of climate change, such as using less fossil fuels and chemicals.
As scientists, sometimes maybe we get frustrated from the standpoint that people don't make radical changes to their operation based on this data or that data. And in all honesty, ranchers, based on experience, feel a conservative approach is the best approach.
And that means Wyoming farmers and ranchers might be contributing to the very problem that's making their livelihoods more difficult. For Jay Norton, the soil guy, that's worrisome.
It's a human-caused problem that we have the ability to deal with, so that's encouraging. We can fix it. The discouraging part is that we're not.
Norton says he hopes farmers and ranchers will take climate change seriously and make adjustments to protect the long-term viability of Wyoming's agriculture. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Melody Edwards.
Coming up, Wyoming's ranking as a bike-friendly state is dropping, and we will have a Wyoming story with a former warden. This is Open Spaces. Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. Wyoming's ranking as a bike-friendly state continues to drop. The state ranks 36th after ranking 33rd last year and 11th in 2010. The loss of stature has concerned the director of Wyoming Pathways, Tim Young. He's been speaking with the Wyoming Department of Transportation about the issue, and he joins us to discuss the report.
This report was principally looking at the state level. What is the state doing in terms of the categories of policies and programs, legislation and enforcement, infrastructure and funding?
Now, you were just speaking with the director of the Department of Transportation here in our state and talking with him about this. What are some of the fixes you see out there?
Well, one thing to keep in mind, it's not just YDOT's job to address bicycling and walking. Programs come to them to manage, but there's also a role for the legislature, for example. And the questions I think we can ask looking at this, are there improvements to state laws that might make conditions safer for bicycling and walking? And what changes would be appropriate? Another one that's really a legislative question, is the state investing sufficiently in facilities for communities to build their biking and walking systems? Are they getting the support they need? So that's those questions for the legislature. I think there's a role for Governor Mead as he's looking at state investments in these types of active transportation modes to help realize the benefits. We can document economic benefits, health benefits, and quality of life benefits where communities collaborating with the state have improved their bicycling and walking systems.
Yeah, and I wanted to just follow up on that. I know you did quite a summit on this last year discussing these things, but the findings have been that, the friendly bicycle regulation really does help communities. If people are looking to move to a community, this is a big deal to them.
It's one of those measuring points that new businesses take a look at, and we've actually seen examples of businesses, for example, in Cheyenne, that we're looking for a place to site a business, Lowe's, a big distribution center. And when they discovered the Greenway system Cheyenne has, it was one of those turning points. They said, this is a place we would like our employees to be able to live and raise a family.
Mm-hmm. I have to tell you, Tim, I have never I've done this a long time, and I'm trying to remember if I've ever heard of any bike legislation that's come up before the legislature. I'm sure it's happened before, but it's not been something that you hear committees debate or discuss quite a bit. What would you be looking for from them?
I think there's opportunities for looking at on the legislative side for how are the current laws working for us in Wyoming. For a couple of years ago, the legislature did remove what they call a mandatory side path law. And that now bicyclists, if there's a pathway on the side or the road, they can decide which they feel more comfortable in. So that was one legal legislative change that was made. I think that looking at a complete streets kind of policies is another opportunity where when you're designing a road or a street or a highway, considering the needs of all the users that are there. And if it's the bicycling and walking or components and having to address safe crossings for the street, those can be done as a part of an improved policy. And it may not necessarily require a law, but it could certainly be a state policy that the DOT could could adopt within the agency.
It looks like funding might be a big thing for – maybe it's more of a funding situation to give to communities to develop a
– The communities have benefited greatly by a couple of programs YDOT manages. The Transportation Alternatives Program, it's a federally funded program that YDOT does a tremendous job with creating a community grant program. Communities in Laramie has been one that's received funds, but there's been several dozen communities across the state that have benefited by the transportation enhancements. It used to be called, it's called Transportation Alternatives now. And that builds community greenways, pathways. It can do pedestrian crosswalks and sidewalks. It's been very successful. And looking at ways to leverage those federal funds with some smart state investments in support of our community's needs, I think that's one of the ways we could really see this score climb up in the next couple of years.
Do you see this as a positive thing in the sense that you're at least talking about some of these issues?
Absolutely. I mean, it's commendable that YDOT is willing to take a look critically at their programs, evaluate the best practices that other states are having success with, and to consider the recommendations in this. And the willingness for YDOT to do that, I'm very impressed with. And I think that's – my sense is that YDOT's willing to do that. And I hope both on the governor's side and the legislature's side, they can assist in that.
Tim Young of Wyoming Pathways, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob.
In 1967, Rawlins resident Duane Schillinger was hired by the Wyoming State Penitentiary as a counselor. Later, through an unexpected turn of events, he ended up serving as warden for 17 years. In this Wyoming story, he remembers the transition from the 19th century facility to the current one and the relationships he formed with inmates.
I spent about 16 years over here in this old prison, what's now called the Wyoming Frontier Prison. I was actually the last warden at that prison, and then I was the first warden at the new prison. And I also hold the dubious distinction of being the longest-serving warden in Wyoming prison history. It's often been said that those early prisons were built, that when a prisoner saw them, you know, they would immediately be in fear, you know, that the state was in charge, the state was, this kind of a monster that was going to control their life. And that's kind of what the old prison looked like, you know, cold walls and bars. And so then the new prison was designed, and the inmates at first resisted. They did not want to leave over here. You know, they had their life situation pretty well established. They knew their routine. They had their cell fixed the way they wanted it. They had the hobby work and so forth. And this over here was, you know, totally unknown. They had no idea what they were going to be moved into. One old inmate told us, he says, "I'm not going to go over there. You're going to have to drag me over. I'm not going to go." So my deputy warden, his name was Jim Ferguson, and I, we talked a little bit about it, how what we were going to do with him. And I said, "Let's just leave him here until we get everybody moved, and then we'll come back and sit down with him, and he'll be the last one to go." So we've got everybody moved, and on the first day and the second day, and he was still down there waiting for us. "I'm not going to go. You're not going to make me go." And then when we got him all over there, we went and found him. He was living in there all by himself. And, of course, we had some guards. But he had taken all of the mattresses out of the cells, neatly stacked them. He had swept the floor and mopped the floor. It was immaculate. And he just said, "Okay, I'm ready to go." And so he was the last one that we took over there. But I was being prepped to be the warden, you know, they told me to keep an eye on what type of a community you want out there. What are you going to do? Well, I had some ideas. As I look back on it now in my older age, I think, oh, that was foolish. That was youthful excitement, you know, that kind of propelled me in. But anyhow, I wanted to develop a community where they had a responsibility within that community. They had a role to play, and that role was being a good citizen, you know, treating other people decently, courteously, backing away from the violence, trying to do what they could to, you know, foster their own well-being, better their education. Let me tell you a little story here about one inmate. He was a young kid. In fact, he still writes letters to me, and I answer him. He came in. He was a life sentence, and he was just a little pain in the rear end. I mean, he was hard to manage, and we did everything we could with him to try to get him on the straight and narrow, get him involved and so forth, and he just would not accept guidance. He didn't want to be involved. He wanted to be a little hoodlum. I got to the point where there wasn't anything else I could do with him. I had him locked up in the last place I could lock him up, all by himself. And at that particular time, we had a semi-religious program come in, and they had done a lot of work in prisons. And one of the interesting people in that program was a car driver for Al Capone. I still remember this. I got with this fellow and told him about this kid. And I told him, I said, you know, we don't know what else to do with him. I said, you know, I just hate, he's young, I hate to just lock him up. And I said, would you talk to him? And he said, yeah, I'll talk to him. So I went back, and this kid's name was Scott. I sat down with him, and so I told him, I said, Scott, you know, I don't know what I'm going to do with you. You know, I've come to the end of my rope, and I hate to just write you off. I said, here's the deal. And I told him about this program. I told him about this old convict. This old guy had white hair, and you could see, you know, the just looking at his face, the experiences he had been through, and told him that he was Al Capone's car driver. And I said, will you talk to him? Yeah, I'll talk to him. So that night we had the program, and of course there was, you know, a lot of religion mixed into it. And the leader, you know, toward the end of the program asked, now, would anybody like to come up and give themselves to Christ? And lo and behold, this kid popped out of his chair and walked up there. And that was the change in his life. And, you know, he's still connected with me. I tried to make it a decent place for them to live. Every one of them that came in, I met every inmate when they first came into the prison, sat down and had a chat with them, and I told them, now, these are your options. I said, you can come in here and be a jerk, be a criminal if you want to, be a hood, or, you know, you can try to start getting your life squared away. And I'd point them out some of the programs we had, and that was the beginning of it. Then I would meet all of the inmates. You know, I'd walk through the yard. I would spend time in their cell with them, and they called me Dad. The prison was the big part of my life. You know, I've spent almost 29 years in that prison, and it's hard to separate thoughts now from the prison and get a little bit emotional when I think about it.
That was produced by Adrian Shirk. That's our program for this week. If you'd like to hear it again or listen to individual segments, go to our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. There you can also submit ideas for future programs and sign up for our podcast. Anna Rader is our web editor. We also invite you to become a fan of our Wyoming Public Radio News Facebook page, and you can follow all of our reporters on Twitter, including our newest ones, Melody Edwards and Aaron Schrank. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.